Hello. Today on the Loopcast, I have Cryptia, Scott Turbin, and we are discussing the strategy of leaks. So from 2008 to 2018 has been sort of, as a decade has proven, a banner decade for leaks and leaking. So from the different phases of WikiLeaks, you have Snowden, you have Chelsea Manning, you have the Podesta emails, you have the Panama Papers, and you have the Paradise Papers. We've seen a lot of leaks for various reasons. You know, it's nation-state warfare, it's ideological, it's political, it's for the lulz, it can be any of those. What is yet to be discussed in sort of public forums or in doing analysis, at least as far as we've been able to look for it, there hasn't been sort of this top-level discussion of, you know, where do we fit leaks into a strategic picture? Are leaks themselves strategic? You know, what is the top view and the, you know, the top view consideration of leaks and leaking? So today, Cryptia is going to help me sort of discuss this and maybe come up with a better answer than I don't know. So let's start. I want to start off with just like a very simple question, which is when we discuss what leaking is, you know, how do we define a leak? How do we define, for instance, what WikiLeaks has done, what the Panama Papers have done, and sort of come up with a definition of what leaking is or isn't?
Right. Well, I would say that a leak, quote unquote, in the nomenclature you're kind of discussing here, would be where an individual or a group takes information that is private, that is hidden. It's something that's inside someone's network or their email system or whatever, and gives it to either the general public by publishing it on the web, or they take it and they give it to media, you know, newspapers, CNN, whatever. So that would be the primary difference. Instead of like an open source leak would just be somebody put this stuff on a web server by accident and it's been spidered by Google and cached. And, you know, you could take it from there. Either someone like me comes along, finds it, and I blog post about it. You know, that's, it's still a leak sort of, but it's not like I took it and I shopped it to the New York Times.
Interesting. So, and then to sort of add to your definition, where do we include something like the Strava sort of posting, the sort of the output from all the Fitbits and the sort of exercise trackers? So that wouldn't, in your definition, wouldn't be a leak. That would be sort of open source intelligence that has sort of been, that has been posted for public consumption.
Yeah, it falls more into that than anything else, as far as I can tell from what I have seen, unless this information was out there and then was pointed to by some secret source that gave it to a new source, wants to be kept, you know, away from the prying eye of the public, or, you know, if a nation state or a service decides to give it to somebody like the New York Times, you know, it's kind of like a, this whole thing with the DNS and Trump back in the day during the campaign. Was his server talking to Russia, that whole thing? An anonymous source was running around trying to get people to write about it, you know, trying to get the news services to pick it up. And, you know, who was that? Who really was that? We really don't know. What's the motivation?
So then I want to maybe sort of, you know, how do we relate leaking to strategy in the sense of, you know, making something public and classified, or something private and classified public? How does that, you know, how do we consider that strategic? What is, you know, in a broad view, what is the impact and what is sort of the reasoning for that?
Right. Well, the reasoning and the impact kind of go together. So if you are some person who works at a company that's doing illegal things, let's say, and you have that evidence, and this is ostensibly how WikiLeaks started, right? They said if your company or if the government's doing something bad, and you know about it, you can give it to us and we can publish it so it becomes, you know, public knowledge, comes into the light, can be acted upon by legal bodies to stop it, to look into it. That's one thing. So if you are an individual and you find your company is doing something bad and you want that to stop, but you feel you don't have any power to do so, or the repercussions would be too much, you can post it on WikiLeaks, right? Another motivation might be that you are a nation-state actor, or you are an intelligence service, which would be nation-state actor, but, you know, say you're a private intelligence service. you can take that information, and depending on the content, if you want to aim it at destroying the credibility of a company or a nation or government, you can do that. And that's the problem with the defining line of, okay, what is real, what is not. You're taking information that the government or the company or the individual may or may not actually say, yeah, that's mine, right? That it's true, that, this is real. They may just lie and say it's not, or it may not actually be data that they really had. It might be disinformation, right? So motivation really has to be looked at from the perspective of the data that's out, how it was put out, and the vetting that can be done. If you can't prove that the data is real, it's all circumstantial.
That's an interesting sort of thing you bring up, is that we generally consider the leaks that have been made public, sort of from WikiLeaks, from Snowden, from Manning, to the Paradise Papers and Panama Papers, they're generally considered to be true. And yet, you do bring up this interesting point that, you know, it's only true if somebody endorses it and says, yes, that's indeed our data. But at the same time, you could argue that really this is misinformation or disinformation. And so, I mean, in that sense, which has more of an impact then? Is it better to leak and to be true, or is it better to leak, to give the appearance of leaking and sort of create disinformation?
Depends on your goal, right? We just saw in 2016 the disinformation campaigns, and that whole active measures attack relied on both fake and real data, right? The leaks of the DNC emails were a real leak, but if you went to DC Leaks instead of WikiLeaks or wherever else, there was some manipulation of the data to mislead for disinformation purposes. So you have to look at every leak as an analyst would, as to, okay, what is it? Where is it supposed to be from? Can it be proven to be real data? Is there any false data salted in there? And then look at it from, okay, why are they doing it? What's the motivation of the individuals, the groups that are releasing this data, whether it be true or false or a little of both? What's the goal here? And so what used to be, you know, I think in all of our minds, in a simpler time, what a leak was, say, at the beginning of WikiLeaks, or even let's go back further. Let's go back to the Pentagon Papers. The Pentagon Papers were leaked because the government was lying to the populace. There's a lot of stuff in those papers, and as they started digging really through it, they were finding the nuggets of, you know, what the government knew and what the government was saying to the populace. Two different things. Now, post-2016, post this disinformation warfare that really just sort of exploded last year, 16-17, can we really know? Unless we do a lot of digging to find out what that information really is. Is it real? Is it not? It took, for the Paradise Papers, it took them years of going through that stuff secretly, parsing it out to all of the different news agencies with reporters to vet the information and then make the connections that would potentially lead to indictments. I think there's been some. I think that a lot of that is still being kind of dug through, and it gives you context to even what happened with the information war by Russia against the United States. You know, the monetary connections. This may still play a part in what may or may not happen with the Russia investigation, because you're seeing all the Russian oligarch money through Panama. You can see those LLC connections. You can see where the money is, where it's going, where it came from. So it's a double-edged sword, really.
I mean, that's an interesting point you bring up, because you're sort of hinting at the role of the mediator to bring information to light. Because I remember the Vice documentary. I think it was on the Panama Papers, and then the Paradise Papers. It just behind the scenes look was like, to your point, they were, you know, they had reporters, and then they had a separate pool of analysts that were going through, you know, doing follow up work, confirming that in fact these documents were true. But then I compare this to something like WikiLeaks, which really seems like they didn't, you know, they don't redact. They just, you know, it's sort of pump and dump. It's sort of just throw it out there and let you as the individual be the mediator, as opposed to trained reporters and trained analysts. So then, you know, what I'm trying to get at is, you know, where do we place the mediator of leaks in this?
Right. Well, the the media itself, the way that the press is supposed to be, is this impartial body that will take that information and do the reporting, do the digging, connect the dots, bring us the truth, right? Unfortunately, with WikiLeaks, it started off with that notion, but because of Assange and his ego, is control over the organization, the cult of personality that it became, it's much more less trustworthy in my mind, and I think in many others' minds. It became so, you know, quite quickly after some of the things started coming out about the leaks from Afghanistan and Iraq wars, that you could see that they wanted to just dump the data without sanitizing, that could get innocent people killed. Innocent Iraqis were killed in some cases because the leaks just went out without being vetted or sanitized. In today's world, with WikiLeaks and their activities, really Assange's connections and activities seems to indicate that the Russians have some measure of control over, you know, what is supposed to be an organization that is for the people and supposed to be supporting freedom and bringing light to everything, right? The leaking of information where the government is doing wrong has turned into a propaganda tool, a disinformation tool. So the mediator, as you say, has to be looked at as well as the data as to what's the motivation. Is it a body that is independent and able to collate that data and regurgitate it into a fashion where, you know, the general public can consume it, and then they can, if they're more interested, go to the actual source and look through the data. What I don't hear a lot about in a lot of these leaks is, okay, have we looked at the metadata? Have we done the forensics to ensure that this hasn't been tampered with, that it does seem to have come from this source? I don't hear that a lot. In reporters' worlds, they'll go talk to the government or talk to the military and say, I've got this stuff. Can you confirm or deny that this is your stuff? So you really, when we all start to get leaks, we start to see them online, we should be asking those questions. Like, who put it out? Why do you think it's out? And who is holding it? who's the one that's reporting on it. If it's just something online, well, you can do that yourself. But, you know, you still have to wonder about the motivation.
I mean, I think there's to a degree. There's something gossipy about leaks. So, for instance, the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers are very serious. And what WikiLeaks has leaked out, at least with Afghanistan, Iraq, what Chelsea Manning leaked, is very serious. But then we sort of come to the Podesta emails, and they're very mundane. They're obviously designed to be private, right? And they're private communications between people. But it very, very much had this feeling of taking something that isn't classified but private, making it public, and it had this weird, gossipy, illicit nature, which then is immediately picked up. You know, look at John Podesta's risotto recipe, or, you know, it's just, it's of this nature that, it's supposed to be private, but then it's made public, and then it has this aura of illicitness and gossipiness.
Right. Well, it adds to the salacious kind of nature of certain types of leaks. And in the case of the Podesta mails, that was clearly an effort of the Russians to kind of gin up things. Because, like you said, it was pretty pedestrian. I mean, it wasn't really, oh, my God, you know, what's he saying? You know, what's in there? Even the leaks of the cables for the sex state type stuff wasn't really that revelatory. There were a few things in there about certain players, but you know, the most you got was who didn't like who, you know, what people in the know who were dealing with these other countries' emissaries thought of them, that kind of stuff. It wasn't like, we got the secret sauce, you know, Mission Impossible, we escaped with this, you know, data. No real smoking guns, per se. So in the case of Podesta, that was just added schadenfreude. When they couldn't come up with something that was really bad, they just sort of threw it out there and said, oh, my God, look at this. You know, just added to the synergy of Hillary's bad, Podesta's bad, and just hoped that it would add to the fervor that they were building.
This might seem silly, but it almost seems like, you know, when you take that data and make it public, it almost seems it lends itself to conspiracy building, because with the Podesta emails, I think, if I remember correctly, it's when Pizzagate and Spirit something started. I think Pizzagate ultimately becomes the more sort of infamous of the two conspiracies, but it seems like when you move data, private data, make it public, give it this aura of illicitness, it, you know, it sort of lends itself to people creating conspiracies. Now, I don't know if that's the fault of, you know, a lack of good mediation, or it's simply politically, you know, convenient and easy to create a conspiracy, but it really does seem like when you start putting things out into the public, it does loan itself to conspiratorial thinking towards, you know, this idea that nothing is real and everything is possible sort of conception of the world.
Right. Well, I believe that the Podesta emails came out on DC Leaks, and DC Leaks Guccifer 2.0 was shopping that with various people, including the Nixon guy who worked for Trump as well.
Oh, Roger Stone.
Stone, yeah. He was talking to Stone on DM, and one of the actual quotes was, Podesta's in the barrel next. So you're looking at a source, which is Guccifer 2, which is a known Russian operative code name, whatever you want to call it, whoever's running it, and it's probably more than one person, leaking that data and making, trying to make it sensational or trying to up the Schadenfreude, right?
Yeah.
So this was clearly a tool in the disinformation campaign. So, you know, that was all the goal, was to create that seediness, create that conspiratorial notion in people's minds. And people, the general populace, those who are within the cognitive distance space of what I would consider Trumpers to be, will take that and they'll read into it. They'll read whatever their bent is, they'll read into it. They will not look at it dispassionately as an analyst and say, you know, what's here? What does it say? So there was no there, but they wanted to spin it in order to get people to talk about it and be, you know, jazzed about it in their space, their echo chamber.
That's interesting that you bring that up, because it almost seems like that when you release leaks, that there's almost like a targeting process that goes on, that I want to release this data and have it either affect or have it be consumed by this population. And I compare that to early WikiLeaks and sort of up to the Manning, the State Department cables. And it almost seems like in the beginning it was very this shotgun approach. We're going to dump it, you know, and the target consumer is everybody. And then when you get to 2016, it seems like there's this refinement of, okay, everybody can consume these leaks, but really it's targeted towards the most motivated and the most likely to sort of, you know, properly hashtag it and run with it.
Right. Yeah. It's, like I said, it's a tool. It is a tool for good and ill, depending on your motivation. So, you know, I can, from my perspective, from just what I found in the darknet, the texts of the Manafort's, right? That was dumped on a obscure darknet site for an anonymous collective, just dumping things. And it had been there a little while. I looked at it, I downloaded the file, and I started to vet it. And once it really seemed to check out, I started to write about it. And I combed through the data looking for the interesting bits, and I blogged what I found. You know, all the things that said that this character is not a good guy. There wasn't much else in there that said he was a great guy anyway, but I put that data out there, but I also put the spool itself and where I got it and said, okay, I found this. This is a leak. They got hacked. And once the media picked up on it, the media connected with Manafort and asked him the key question that I did not ask. They asked him if these are their texts. And he said, yeah, the phone got hacked. So he confirmed it. So everything within those texts then becomes the truth, right? He hasn't at all said, no, that's not real. Everything in there that was said was true, according to, it was their texts. They had those conversations. His daughters and whoever else, and he in that spool. So the leak technically comes from me in the sense that it got published that way. But originally it was in a non-group from Ukraine. And there may be a political motive there, because Manafort worked in Ukraine. And these people were leaking it saying, this guy's dirty. Take a look.
I mean, that sort of brings up an interesting question, because, you know, how do you trust? Like, I know, like, defining trust is kind of difficult, but, I mean, and you sort of touched on it already, but, you know, how do you trust what you're seeing? I mean, you know, the idea that you can manufacture something and then create a context in which to sort of insert that manufacture, you know, it almost seems like, you know, I mean, I guess you can't really sort of, it would be difficult to sort of, you know, falsify forensics. It's doable, but it would require technical skill. But, you know, the idea of leaking really speaks to the idea, you know, to this underlining idea of, you know, trusting trust. What or who or whatever do you trust? And is this information reliable?
Right. Yeah. It's on what I was looking at. I did the forensics. I did the metadata. You know, I checked it out. It seemed to be legit. When I wrote my blog post, I said, this is what I did. This seems to be legitimate information. Backstopping, you know, I could prove that these were their phone numbers. This is all checking out. But I said, this is information that I got in the dark net. So take that at face value, right? If this is true, then there's some pretty damning things being said about this family by the family in this leak. Once he had said, yep, you know, this is what happened, daughter's phone got hacked, well, then he admits to it. The reality is that if you wanted to, you could probably insert texts into that SQL database. If, you know, if you really do high-end forensics on it, you may not be able to say, you know, okay, that's a real one. You know, that's the fake one that got inserted later. But who out there, like I said earlier, is doing that? How many sources, you know, these mediators are actually taking time to do the forensics to ask somebody like me to look at it and say, yeah, is this legit or not? You know, technically this looks legit. Okay, we'll move on to the next thing. Most of the time it's just dump stuff online and the media picks it up and they run with it. The problem being, circling back to, is this your information or is this secret information? Is this private information? Some places will just disavow any knowledge of it because it's going to look bad for them either way, right? So they can disavow it. They can say, no, that's not our stuff. But the people who want to believe it will still believe it. The damage is still done, right? If you're looking to harm the character perception of somebody, you could create, you could gin up data, put it in with some real data, and get away. You know, even if it's found to be faked stuff later on, the damage is already done in the public mind. That's the problem.
This is sort of an interesting question that you sort of pose, which is, you know, is it more worthwhile to insert data, false data, into something that is true, or is it more worthwhile to delete true data from something that is true? In the sense of, if I remember correctly, when WikiLeaks sort of dumped the Syria files or something, they went through and they deleted something that like was a connection between Syria's bank and Russia's. Like there was an interaction between a Syrian bank and the government of Russia. This was covered by Howell. I forget his first name, but he had pointed out that, in fact, there was deletion going on, that the mediator, Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, was sort of editing this to make, you know, his assumed patron look better or not look worse. So to circle back to my original question, I mean, is insertion more of a valuable tool here, or is deletion? Like, is it?
I'd say they're equal because it depends on what you're trying to do, right? So the theory is that Russia, his Russian contacts told Assange, this data has some bad looking stuff for us. Delete it. You know, make us look better or make us disappear out of this. Let's shape the information bomb, right? So either or, you're still doing the same kind of thing. If you are putting out egregious bad things into falsehoods into something, it's just as bad as deleting truths, right? It depends on your goals. And if the goal is to deceive, it's the same, right?
Then, I mean, there's this other component of denial of service, of that basically you throw so much information and data at people that they become overwhelmed and they sort of stop processing. The fire hose of propaganda was a RAND paper that is out there. But also, like, just from my daily interactions on Twitter and then sort of the news constantly being sort of pushed out, that it's so difficult to sit here and establish what is true, you know? And because the rate of data coming at you is so quick and so fast that, you know, that it sort of disables your ability to mediate and to sort of say, well, this is true, I've confirmed it, but this is false, so I'm going to ignore it.
Right. Yeah, it's as individuals, it's really hard to parse through the volumes of information that you're getting, the constant stream of data, almost yelling at us in a way. I mean, Twitter being, I mean, look at, it's just a fire hose of different people's notions. How many times have you clicked on retweet of something and then later on somebody said, yeah, by the way, I looked at Snopes and that's wrong. You know,
I care to admit to.
Right. You know, you can't, we've reached a point with our social media and the media in general where there's no way we can backstop everything we see and everything we like. If we did, we'd spend half our time just going to different sources, because you can't just go to Wikipedia, because anybody can add that stuff or delete that stuff, right? It's a constant battle. So you get, like in reporting, three sources, right? You get three confirmed sources, then you can run with it. Kind of got to do that with now with your, with whatever you're seeing, right? It's crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean, I want to maybe take a sidestep and discuss sort of the role of ideology in leaking. Because doing the research for the show, you know, we started with WikiLinks. Sort of the earliest incarnation of WikiLinks was, you know, we're bringing to light what is in the dark, and, you know, there was a justice argument inherent to what they were saying, that at least the early incarnation. And then you have, you know, Snowden and Chelsea Manning, that also seemed sort of ideologically driven, that they were solving for some sort of injustice or some sort of violation of human rights. And then it's almost same with the Panama and Paradise Papers, that it's all about ideology and then a political aim, sort of righting what is wrong. So my question to you is, I mean, how much does ideology sort of factor in to leaking and to a leaker's sort of intentions, original intentions?
Well, I'd go back to the first big leak for me was the Pentagon Papers. The ideology there was, Daniel was in the middle of the whole thing. He was doing the work, putting together the papers, you know, some of the information. And he saw that we were being lied to, and that ethically for him was wrong for the government to do. So he did what he did. Some might go a little further and try to put a more psychological framework to this as well. You know, what are your personal goals of doing this, right? What's the psychology behind it? In espionage, you have, mice. The reasons why somebody's going to spy for you, right? So you judge them as to how you can approach them to get them to spy. Is it money? Is it power? Is it feeling like you're not respected, that kind of stuff. So you have that aspect as well. And some people had said, you know, Daniel was kind of egotistical, and there was that component as well. But let's just lay it on the face of, you saw what was wrong, you saw the government doing it whole cloth, and decided to get the truth out there, right? Okay, that's Pentagon Papers. You had as well the whole thing with Nixon and Watergate, the 70s as well. So you see that the government's been lying to you, right? Let's flash forward to the 1990s, late 80s, 90s. The X-Files. The X-Files was a zeitgeist because people picked up on that idea that the government is lying to you. The truth is out there, right? It was a TV show. But look at the same time frame. You got Art Bell on the radio talking about conspiracies and UFOs and all that stuff. Pretty popular. So there's this whole thing. They even had him on The X-Files as a character. So you've got this conspiratorial thing going on where a lot of people believe that the government's lying to you, that there's lizard aliens and there's Illuminati and all that stuff. But back in the 90s, it wasn't as rampant as you fast forward to 2001 to now, where you've got Alex Jones and his crazy, crazy, crazy conspiracies that people eat up, right? So you've got all of that. Just take that as an underlying flow of the psyche of at least, let's just say, America, right? Leading up to Trump with conspiracies. It's all about conspiracy for him. Climate change. It's a Chinese conspiracy. He's a friend of Alex Jones. He's putting out all kinds of conspiracies, even today on Twitter. You know, Russia thing, it's all about Hillary and uranium. Kaka. You know, it's all just spinning tails. Now you take that component of leaking information. What if I create a database of information that passes the smell test up to a point that it looks like real government information and I want to dump it that supports, you know, this Russia thing. Let's go with like the Nunez memo. That's an analogous leak, quote unquote, right? They got it declassified. But what did it really mean? It was a nothing burger, but it's feeding the base. It's feeding the people who have that bent. So when you talk about leaks, for me, once again, it's just about the agenda of the person leaking it, and then the agenda of the people mediating it, and then the agenda of every person reading it.
Holy crap. You know, to your point, it reminds me of, I think somebody was sort of trolling on Twitter, and they put out they edited a Kanye West music video and then billed it as the P-tape, right? The infamous yep. P-tape. And it just blew my mind that the first tweet was the troll tweet, right? And it had maybe 10 upwards of thousands of retweets and favorites. And then the rest of the thread, he basically explains how he trolled. Like, no, this is just an edited Kanye West video. I just threw some graphics on it. But everybody retweeted it. Everybody thought it was the real P-tape. And to your point, it almost seems like the leaker, the mediator, and the ultimate sort of consumer are all sort of part of this act of, you know, the consumer sees what he wants to see and the mediator sort of provides that. Whether it's true or not, it maybe could be irrelevant. So
yeah, I mean, it all becomes very philosophical. I mean, you're going to have to get deep dive into philosophy in a way to kind of come to grips with all of it. And, you know, and if, okay, so you got a real dump and it's real data, you know, like Snowden stuff, being parsed out, what really came of all that? Have we had substantive change? if anything, that fed the cognitive dissonance of all the people who were just saying, oh my God, the government's listening to everything we do. When the reality is, maybe not. You know, yeah, the capacity's there. It's kind of scary. If an individual has the power to do so and orders other people below them to do something, potentially you could be listened to illegally. But what are you going to do about it? What can you do about it?
Interesting. I mean, I think with the Snowden leaks, it was... The argument is that Russia has been making this argument, has been pushing this idea forward of, I'm sort of butchering it, but the idea of a national internet as opposed to all nation states being interconnected. And I mean, this thesis sort of puts a lot of intention on Snowden's shoulders, but it was the idea that if you reveal U.S. surveillance, that you can begin to politically sort of contract or create a narrative to contract the US's ability to run this, you know, level and depth of surveillance. But to your point, I mean, have we actually seen any change? Have we seen any sort of alteration in behavior? I don't, you know, I'm not aware of, or, you know,
well,
we don't know.
In the case of the Snowden leaks and what you just talked about, they've used that as their aegis to forward their own agenda of balkanizing the internet. So they've got SORM version 3 that is, you know, controlling their environment, right? They're working with China. They signed a deal. So they are sharing information somewhat on attacks, but they're also sharing the actual technologies in some cases. So SORM is going to have more of the Great Firewall technology, and China will have more of the SORM technology. But the idea is, at the core, both countries want to stop the hegemony of the United States on the internet. So Snowden's leaks were the perfect tool to do that and to get more buy-off from other countries that may feel likewise, right?
Yes. So, I mean, that sort of brings us to my last question, which is, can you wage information warfare now without leaks? Because, circling back to my original sort of the introduction, 2008 to 2018 has not only been a banner decade for leaks, but also a banner decade for sort of cybersecurity, an evolution in cybersecurity, you know, going from, you know, in 2008, 2009, we had Stuxnet, we had Dooku, we had Flame, and then we end the decade with sort of information warfare coming back and sort of showing, you know, becoming very public how you can attack, you know, you can attack nation states through social media and through public media. So for my original question, you know, can you wage information warfare nowadays without leaks?
It depends on the level or the scale that you want to carry out that information war on. So let's just, you know, you were talking about Flame and Dooku earlier on, and I would say, okay, now we're circling back to NotPetya, to some of the North Korean attacks using ransomware or cryptors or even wipers, right? So those types of warfare acts are not necessarily going to need a disinformation component or a leak component, right? Unless they wanted to do that kind of damage. So you've got, you know, like modules. Let's just put it into a modular kind of sense of information warfare. So if I just want to strike out, cause fear, cause financial damage to a government or a company, I could release like NotPetya in Ukraine, if I'm Russia, and destroy networks, destroy the usefulness of those networks, the usefulness of the data that is now destroyed or encrypted, or, you know, even down to the point of getting hard drives to kind of eat themselves, right? It causes that damage. It causes the fear. It causes the financial damage. Now, recently, there was talk about NotPetya. And once you let that genie out of the bottle, it didn't just hit Ukraine, because the internet is the internet. It's connected everywhere, right? So this thing escaped the bottle, and it hit in the UK. It hit, you know, Maersk, all these other places. And it's become, to some, the most financially destructive piece of malware yet, because it ran around with Eternal Blue and did its thing. There was no need for a leaking of information on that one. So it all depends on your goals. You know, what does your operation want to do? So I think, you know, if it's an individual looking to leak something, that's what's their goal. If it's somebody who's been wronged by a company, they're going to, if they have the access, they buy the access, whatever, they're going to release what's damaging to that person or entity that they want to take down and cause pain to, or maybe hopefully justice to prevail. Right? If you are a nation state and you want to attack the American election system, you're going to use leaks. You're going to use hacking to get leaks. And that's your goal. That's your aegis right there, is to do that kind of damage, to sow chaos. And that's what they did. So really, if you look at the Gerasimov Doctrine and some of the other Russian information warfare books, you really get a sense of, okay, you can pick and choose. It depends on what your goal is at the end of it. And it's all layer upon layer. So if you want to commit an all-out warfare war on somebody, you could use all those tools.
That's interesting. Because, that's really interesting, because it seems like there's this division in InfoSec where you can attack a trust network, right? Or you can sort of attack a network of computers. And, you know, they both have different effects. But it almost seems like when you attack a trust network, yeah, it does require a little more political science data, a little more historical data, but it almost seems like that when you attack trust, something that's so fundamental, you really are, you know, it has the potential for destruction that is pretty huge. I mean, to go back to your point, like, you know, the difference between, you know, NotPetya attacking FedEx and causing $400 million in damage, you know, FedEx can, you know, they can rebuild their systems, they can recoup that $400 million, but attacking the U.S. election system seems a little more, the damage seems a little more longer lasting and maybe even deeper, you know, attacking an institution.
Right. Well, you know, attacking an institution like elections. Okay. So they did hack election systems where the roles for individuals are in states, right? The government or the state governments have admitted at least, what, 21 of them, something like that? I don't know. I don't forget the count, but a bunch of them have admitted that their systems were breached. We don't know how far. We don't know what the persistence is, right, or was. Are they still in those systems? We don't know. But the fact that they got into those systems and that knowledge that it did happen is out, does that mean that the people who vote, who know that these systems have been compromised, and if they're smart enough to think maybe still compromised, would they not vote because of that? Are they going to change their behavior in some way? And alternatively, back to the more technical side, so I hack into the registries, the roles, and I change just like where you live. If you show up as an individual and you present your ID and it says you live at, you know, 123 Street, but on the rolls it says you live at 321 Street, potentially you can't vote that day because that role has been changed. You're degrading not only the trust in the system, but this, you're subverting the system itself to disallow votes.
I mean, by the same token, I mean, a lot of voter rolls are a matter of public knowledge. So, you know, in Colorado, you can look up who is active, who is not, and sort of do that. And so it almost seems like, you know, you could also use the sort of openness of the system against it, because, you know, there was an article in 2600 where somebody was able to just use Facebook to sort of build a database of people based on neighborhoods and like locations. And so in my mind, I was thinking, well, if you pair that with a public voter database, Facebook, and then any other open source intelligence, you can sort of begin to target specific people. So, I mean, there's so many layers of trust that it almost seems like it's almost horrifying to think about, to be honest with you.
Yeah, no, really, we are an open society. We tend not to think about this information being in the open or not as privacy freakish as maybe some of us who are in the security field are. And we understand the implications, so the general populace maybe doesn't. And it's fairly easy to make these attacks. And frankly, in the Analytica stuff that we're, you know, eventually hopefully going to hear about, the targeting of voters for Trump and states and everything else, that all that open source information is being used, right? And it's scary.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of blows my mind, because we're discussing leaks as sort of the movement of data that's private and classified to public. But at the same time, when the Strava sort of leaks, not the Strava map, I should say, it's not a leak, it's a map that came out. And it was sort of very mind-blowing to me, because first of all, I thought people's OPSEC would be a lot better than I gave them credit for. And then, you know, bases that should not exist, and then, oh, look at that faint outline of somebody running around the base doing their morning PT. And it's just like, it just blew my mind. Like, you know, it's even if you're in a security tight situation, it's the potential for open source leaks and open source data to be there is still there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's even people in the field make mistakes. They don't think about it. You don't think that when you buy the band, right, and you're tracking your health information per se, you know, your reps and everything else, you're not necessarily thinking that is, okay, where's that going? Is that going to an S3 bucket somewhere that I can just Google up because they haven't done the security properly to, you know, keep it out of other people's hands? You know, it just doesn't occur to people. And if you lived like that, if you looked everything we do with any technical, you know, piece of data, or just going out and buying something with a credit card, you lose your mind.
Wow. it's kind of mind-blowing. Like, it just, like, I don't know, it just, the more I dig into OSINT, and it's just like, wow, just like, you know, it's, you work in an industry where it puts an emphasis on, you know, OPSEC, on security, on, you know, being secret. And then, you know, 10 minutes on Google, and to your point, you found a SW bucket, you know, an S3 bucket, an AWS bucket, and it's, oh, all the legal filings for this financial company. And it's right there. But anyway, so I think we've gone for about 50 minutes, almost to an hour. So I think it's a good place. We've covered a lot, and it's a good place to stop. So I'm going to ask you the last question, which is, you know, give us something to think about, to mull on, and to sort of, you know, think about, you know, before we go for the day.
Well, in considering leaks and their meanings or their uses, I would heed you all to consider this year, because we will see leaks, we will see disinformation just leading up to the elections for Senate and House, right? we've heard from the IC, all the directors of the IC groups this week, this last week, said, yep, they're already spinning up. Russians are spinning up, and they're going to attack this cycle. So that means more social media attacks, more potential leaks of God knows whose emails, disinformation campaigns, trolling, all of it. We just saw the indictment from Mueller on the 13 individuals and the troll farm, and all of that data that's in there. I'm currently kind of parsing through that, trying to see if there's anything else I can latch on to. But Daily Beast already has an article on what seems to be an analogous site that's been spun up for like another troll farm. And it's on a .ru email address that it was set up. It was originally a U.S. user who had the site. Now suddenly it's transferred ownership into this .ru, and nothing of it on the site makes you think that it's Russian. And it's all about controlling your social media, setting up accounts, all that. So it's in a perfect place to spin up more disinformation trolls and cause all the chaos yet again. So consider all this stuff as you see the news every day, or if you're on Twitter and you see these crazy trolls spin up with their MAGA or whatever else to destroy the potential for this candidate or another. Always be wary of what you're reading and try to backstop stuff. Go to Snopes, do a little Googling. I know it's hard, but unfortunately today this is the world we live in.
Well, thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
Thank you. Good time.